Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freundo, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language, and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said apple strudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
IGN Playlist is a new home to your game library. Rate games, share lists, and log your game time powered by How Long to Beat. Sign up for early access today at playlist.ign.com.
Listen! Hello, Super Ninfriendos. Welcome to another episode of Nintendo Voice Chat. I am your host, Cat Bailey, and this is episode 595 of our podcast. Joining me today are four guests. I have with me Per Schneider.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Also, Rebecca Valentine. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm a little concerned about Per's banjo impression, but thank you.
I'm good job calling that out, Reb. And finally, we have a special guest, Fanbytes Imran Khan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I was trying to think of a kazooie sound, but I actually can't think of what kazooie sounds like. I'm glad I said that. I'm glad I teed that up there.
Well done. Can we record really
that? Can we record that and get that on like a sound button or something?
Put it on the soundboard. Make it a drop.
Look,
when
I like
Seth
that
comes
game.
Back, when Seth comes back, just play it like constantly and never tell him what's
That's
going
right.
on.
That's right.
That's right. Our pal Seth Macy is out this week, but he will be back very soon. Don't worry. In the meantime, we have a lot to cover. I have Reb and Imran on here because we're going to be talking about everything that the Microsoft's Activision Blizzard deal means for Nintendo. And yes, there are some implications. We're also going to be talking about Banjo-Kazooie being out on Nintendo Switch. We're going to be talking Nintendo numbers. And of course, there will be the cat take and the rundown and everything that you would expect from an episode of NBC. Before we get to that, though, Imran, you're our special guest. Welcome to the show. How are you doing? And how's 2022 treating you so far?
I'm doing well. 2022 has been a lot of being inside and not going anywhere so far. But so far, like, it's been fine. I've been playing way too much Genshin Impact and Final Fantasy 14 to the point where I'm like, I'm counting down the days until Elden Ring comes out so I can at least get myself off, like, the service game treadmill.
A very non-Tendo 2022 for you so far, then.
So far, yeah. I got back into Super Mario Maker because I remembered that I was making an 8-world, like, course thing. And I got 2 worlds in and just sort of stopped because I ran out of ideas. So now I'm back into it and trying to build levels. And I'm realizing I don't have any more inspiration now than I did then. But I also had a bunch of half-finished ideas I'm now finishing. So hopefully it'll actually limp across the finish line at some point.
Imran, you have appeared on Kind of Funny, and you're also the news editor over on FanBite. We brought you here on the show in part because it was a very news-filled week across the board. Even though Activision Blizzard's acquisition by Xbox was not technically a Nintendo deal, there are reverberations, shall we say, coursing through the industry right now, and Nintendo certainly is being affected by it. So I guess the first question that I'm going to pose to the panel is, having been acquired by Activision, by Xbox for $75 billion, those are some Dr. Evil numbers, how do we expect this to impact games long-term? Pear, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, obviously, the impact on games and on the classic Microsoft versus Sony console war is significant, right? Microsoft is expanding its portfolio of games that they own, publish, monetize in various ways, right? Like, there's free to play Call of Duty, and then there is, you know, fit for Game Pass Call of Duty. So there's obviously a big impact here in Microsoft's quest to become a subscription service. Now, the things we don't yet know is how far will this go? Microsoft would love to put their games on the Nintendo Switch and on the PlayStation and have Game Pass built into every TV on the market, and to monetize not through exclusively through direct sales or free-to-play, but also through the subscription network. Now, I think the impact on Nintendo in this Activision sale, obviously we can't call that yet because, like, you know, even after Microsoft bought Rare, we still got some Rare games on Nintendo platforms. Back then, THQ published Banjo on GBA, and we had Banjo and Smash Brothers that they seem to be getting along pretty well. But from a kind of just from an impact that Activision is off the market as an independent giant publisher of top selling games, I actually think the impact is really small on Nintendo. And that's because there hasn't been a Call of Duty game. The best selling game in the United States, a best selling, you know, traditional packaged goods game, Call of Duty, there hasn't been one on a Nintendo platform since 2013. And the titles that have traditionally done really well on Nintendo platforms from Activision, Skylanders, Guitar Hero, these franchises are all dormant now. So direct impact, I'd say it's pretty small.
Yeah, I think that the direct obvious impact on Nintendo is going to be pretty small ultimately. However, I do think that there are kind of secondary impacts to Nintendo, right? For example, the way that the big games industry is doing business is changing. Reuters had a provocative headline and said that Sony is bringing a knife fight to a global gunfight that Xbox is part of. We are seeing the tech takeover, you could argue, of video games. There was a Resetera thread where somebody said, it's the year 2030 and Facebook and Google and Apple are the big players in the game space. How do you feel about this, mm-hmm. right? And I don't think that's going to be the case. Google has, in particular, shown itself to be pretty incompetent when it comes to it. But Xbox has been very specific in saying that they don't see Nintendo and Sony as a competitor. They see Google and they see Apple as competitors. And that tells you where the games industry is right now. It is no longer the kind of toy business that Nintendo jumped into back in the 1980s. it is a global tech concern, in my opinion. And long term, I think that will absolutely affect how Nintendo approaches the games industry. Reb, you're a business girl. You're a person who knows about this kind of things. What's your take on all of this?
Yeah, consolidation at the level that we are seeing it is obviously a bad thing for many, many, many reasons. We don't want to see every single company get acquired by one, two, or three giants. That has horrible implications for everybody. But on just like a games level, I actually wonder, to sort of dig into the Nintendo thing, I actually wonder if this might end up having a sort of positive impact for Activision Blizzard games on Nintendo, because you're right with the assessment that most of the franchises that have ended up on Nintendo platforms from Activision Blizzard are kind of dormant now. But the thing that I wonder will come out of all this is there's this whole like treasure box of Activision mainly IP that has gone unused, because Activision has pursued very aggressively this strategy in recent years of Call of Duty all the time. And now, you know, Microsoft has talked about and has done in the past situations where they have acquired a studio and then that studio's IP have been able to be used by another studio to make something. Yeah. And so I wonder if the, like, you know, down the line, 5-6 years down the line, we see IP from Activision that we haven't seen in years get picked up either by Activision Blizzard again or by some other studio inside Microsoft and made into something that ends up making it onto the Switch or whatever Nintendo console we're playing then. So that is maybe like the slightly optimistic take out of that. It's a really complicated situation because for a lot of other reasons too, because I think any acquisition is always going to be looked at with, oh, you know, Microsoft just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But Activision Blizzard specifically as a company was in a situation where they really kind of needed some sort of massive change at the top that they weren't getting just by standing around and being Activision Blizzard by themselves with a board and headed up by Bobby Kotick. So yeah, I wonder, there's a lot of question marks on this that I don't think we're going to get answers to until 2023 and later, but at least in terms of how the Switch is concerned, I wonder if it ends up being a plus for people who like playing Nintendo games and like things that Activision Blizzard made like a decade ago.
Yeah, I looked at it. It's really interesting. You said, you know, dormant franchises. You know, Blizzard hasn't made a new StarCraft game in ages, one of my favorite franchises, and it's a total bummer. I wouldn't ever see that go back to, you know, a Switch. And we're seeing Diablo being played here. Diablo on Switch was awesome, right?
Yeah.
These were really good ports, but I feel like the tech, you know, tech is moving on, and like I do feel like the next Diablo games are not going to be able to run on Switch, you know? And like the types of games that Activision and Blizzard have been making over the years moved away from the Lost Vikings and went more towards these kind of more resource-intensive games. But hey, cloud gaming is the great equalizer, right? And I know a lot of our listeners don't love the idea of cloud games because it comes with all the stigma of you know, lag and you don't own the game code or the box game. But at the same time, when connection speeds are so fast that it is no longer an issue, you know, you'll probably get all these Microsoft and Bethesda and Activision and Blizzard games on your Nintendo device if Nintendo lets them, right? If Nintendo sees itself as an open platform that you can stream to.
I heard Kingdom
Internet
Hearts
connection
on
speeds on America's famously reliable internet infrastructure.
Yeah.
Someday.
I heard Kingdom Hearts on Switch was through the cloud and that wasn't any good, but I haven't dug into that very hard.
Yeah. Imran, I'm curious, as our special guest, what's your take?
So I don't know if you ever read Satya Nadella's book, Kat, but like there's a chapter in there where he talks about how Steve Ballmer got him on board with the subscription service, like how that's the next step for Microsoft and like becoming the biggest company in the world, essentially. And I think that's kind of when you look at like him willing to write a check for $70 billion for Activision Blizzard. Like, you see that they really want to go big on, like Reb said, the treasure trove of IPs. Like, having this big Game Pass, like, safe that they can crack open for anyone that's willing to host their games. I think that's where they want to go in the future, probably with Nintendo systems, is what if we didn't give you a single piece of package software? What if you opened it up to xCloud or something like that? I'm sure Nintendo is very hesitant about doing exactly that. But when we're talking about the next 10 years, like the Apple, Google, whatever, like that's what it's probably actually going to look like, is the idea of xCloud and Game Pass and all that on other systems. Like Activision was not a huge supporter of Nintendo. Like, that was Crash and there was Spyro and those games did very well. But Blizzard was. There was a native version of Overwatch. There's, you know, the Diablo 2 port. There was Diablo 3 earlier in the Switch's lifestyle, or lifetime. It makes total sense that what Microsoft can do now is leverage the idea of, hey, we're going to give you the same support, but you got to give us a little something here too. And that's, you know, access to 100 million systems that can get an Xbox account and hopefully a Game Pass subscription.
I'm actually really curious, you know, about free-to-play games from Activision Blizzard and subscription-based games, right? Obviously, WoW and Call of Duty, Warzone monetize so differently from packaged goods. And Microsoft has shown that they aren't, with Minecraft, they didn't really change much, right? Like, they treated Minecraft as its own. I'm wondering if they will be splitting out certain experiences and keep on running them as multi-platform plays, or if, you know, obviously the end game is, you need to be an Xbox subscriber to play a Call of Duty or, you know, play Elder Scrolls and all these big franchises. But I wonder if they're taking a mixed approach there.
Yes.
Well, Minecraft did make one big change, which was you needed an Xbox login. And
that's true.
That's what Sony objected to completely for Minecraft until eventually they did relent. I can, like, just having that, because Microsoft reports on MAUs, like monthly activations. That's what they're going for like their investor calls and their big numbers. I imagine that is exactly what they want from like the Call of Duty Warzone and all that in the future.
Yeah, I think the bigger impact, Kat, you know, just to add one more topic onto this discussion, I think the bigger impact is that this was major cannon fire in the ears of, you know, our friends at Sony, and there is going to be a move, right? Like, big acquisitions like these create this pressure, you know, on public companies to move equal in some way. And there's no way to move equal. There's no other studio of the size, but there are a lot of Japanese developers who would probably not sell to a Western company, who don't want to be in the Microsoft ecosystem, but would sell to the likes of PlayStation. And that could be bad news for Nintendo because, you know, without a Bandai Namco and without, you know, games from Capcom, without stuff like Monster Hunter really lighting up the charts in Japan on Switch, that could be an issue for Nintendo, I think.
Yeah, which is funny, though, because Jim Ryan has been pretty explicit in moving away from Japan in many ways and making Sony far more global. If anything, Sony has been shunning Japan in a lot of ways. So to that extent, it would be a little surprising to me if they made a move to go and acquire a Capcom or a Bandai Namco.
Yeah, well, but those are the exclusive IP that, you know, certainly titles that sell in the West really well. You know, think of Square RPGs and all of that are associated with the PlayStation brand. We got FF7 Remake on the PlayStation exclusively. I feel like there's a big one coming from the PlayStation camp. And Nintendo is not a company that acquires at that level. You know, I mean, they're a little bit more careful. They divested Rare. They sold Rare because it wasn't working for them. I just feel like the next big acquisition is going to be a Japanese company.
Yeah, they bought Next Level Games, but that was because it made sense for them. And they did not buy Monster Games, and now Monster Games is just not making the same thing anymore. What Nintendo does is they invest in technology way more than they invest in studios. It's like we were talking about the streaming services before. They very quietly bought a majority stake in a Japanese streaming service, which is why we have all that our Switch cloud gaming things now. I don't think they would ever buy a Capcom who, I want to say 7 years ago, their shareholders said, yeah, we're open to hearing bids. And since then, they've recovered. But that also says how quickly all that stuff can change.
Yeah.
I've been drum for a while. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Per.
No. Next Level Games was an interesting one, right? That was Nintendo knew something that we didn't know at the time, that Next Level Games was getting so damn good that not having them working on Luigi's Mansion games would be terrible for Nintendo. Like, Luigi's Mansion 3 is Nintendo tier, top tier level game development. Like, they were smart to snatch him up at the time.
It's outsold Ghost of Tsushima. It's a massively selling game.
Wonderful game.
Yeah, and it's funny because Ghost of Tsushima is being treated as this mega hit, but Luigi's Mansion 3 in many ways has been flying under the radar a little bit outside of Nintendo fans.
So. Yeah. If there are people listening to the show who still haven't played it, it's not like Luigi's Mansion 1. It's way, way better.
I've been beating the drum for a little bit personally that Nintendo is diversifying in its own way and becoming a true transmedia company. So Xbox wants to compete with all of the tech concerns. Nintendo wants to compete with theme park developers, and they're turning their IP into movies and things like that. If anything, I sort of wonder if Xbox and Nintendo are just moving in different spaces at this point, where Sony, I mean, I guess Sony is trying to do consumer electronics still, and they have their own thing going on. But it's interesting to see the different strategies that the different platform holders are undertaking.
And it's really, it's born out of Nintendo's history, right? Like, they're, the pixel art and the characters are so emblematic, and there was this whole retro fad which keeps on going. It doesn't seem to end, right? But there are more people who would put a question mark block on their t-shirt than an Xbox logo, right? So it's really smart that they're going in this direction.
Yeah, and Nintendo's been like this for a long time, I think. Maybe, probably ever since the Wii, maybe before that too. They're more experimental. They're not sprinting to compete with PlayStation and Xbox, to their detriment sometimes. I mean, the Wii U was a really sad thing for a lot of people, I think. But the Switch is fantastic, and it's weird. It's fantastic in many ways because it is weird. It is not trying to be this massive, powerful box that plays every single game. And Nintendo's been able to get away with this for so long, for exactly what Per is saying. You know, more people want a question mark t-shirt than anything else, because they have Mario, they have Pokemon, they have Donkey Kong, they have all of the big IP that they have that they will never, ever let anyone else touch. And as long as they have that, and as long as they retain the popularity of those first party things, I mean, I think it would be a huge blow. You're right, if they lost Monster Hunter or Capcom or something like that. But it wouldn't destroy Nintendo. It wouldn't destroy what Nintendo's trying to do. And they can kind of conveniently ignore all of this stuff in some ways. It will impact them in some small ways, but Nintendo is just going to keep on chugging along and doing the things that it does very well, or sometimes very poorly, depending on what tech they're making.
I think it's funny, they've been criticized for being so reliant on their own properties, right? But so if you look back and you look at the Wii and the Wii U and then the Switch library at the top 50 selling games, publisher is Nintendo, 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 right? So they're very fortified against this sort of stuff. If you look at the top selling game on PS4 and PS5 in the last year, it's Call of Duty Vanguard, right? Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a lot of dough that PlayStation got through third-party revenue right there that's gone, potentially gone, right?
Yeah. I think the difference between Nintendo and even with Xbox is that Nintendo doesn't just have IPs, they have characters, recognizable characters like Link and Mario and Pikachu and, you know, mascots, right? And yeah, Xbox has Master Chief and that kind of thing. But so many of the IPs that they got out of Activision Blizzard, it's like Call of Duty. Okay, who is the first person that you think of when you think of Call of Duty? I guess Skull Mask Guy?
Terry Guy?
Yeah.
I always think of Ghost.
Christopher Maloney.
So I think Nintendo has been able to make a lot of hay out of that. But
yeah.
One of the questions I wanted to ask before we moved on was, I feel obligated to ask this, even though I kind of feel like I already know the answer. Microsoft wanted to buy Nintendo 20 years ago. Is there a scenario where that could actually happen?
No.
No, there's no way. I mean, the famous story is that the Nintendo representatives laughed at the idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's no longer a family business, but it's run like a family business. And Nintendo is doing all sorts of stuff, but at the core is still this kind of like toy maker business. Could they be working with a Microsoft to do a little handheld Game & Watch on, you know, one of Microsoft's acquired franchises? Sure, but like outright sell to them? I don't see it.
I feel like the question is there enough shares for Microsoft to buy to make that possible? And the answer is no. They'd have to buy directly from people who have a vested interest in a very successful and long-running Nintendo, who wouldn't probably sell to Microsoft. Wouldn't sell to a Western company, but also wouldn't just sell to Microsoft. I don't think there is an avenue in which that is possible unless we look at like successive Wii U style failures, and that's exactly why you have Furukawa diversifying the way he is with the movies and the theme parks and all that jazz. So even if they do suffer those game failures, they're not at the beck and call of any other company.
I do think acquisition, absolutely not. I do think there is a chance. There were rumors a couple of years ago that turned out to not be anything, that Microsoft was going to put Game Pass on Switch. And that didn't pan out. We got Ori and Cuphead, I think, but we didn't really get much else. I do think there's a future where that does happen, especially if things keep trending the way they're trending, with Microsoft growing Game Pass into this behemoth that can't be ignored, and Nintendo continuing to make things that are not necessarily ideal for big mainstream games. I think there's a world where we get like a modified version of game, especially once that cloud, like you were saying, Parrot, once a cloud is really, really stable and working well for everything through xCloud. I think there's a world where either on the Switch or on a future Nintendo console, we have an Xbox Game Pass app where we can just access all these games through cloud play that wouldn't be available on Nintendo otherwise. And then Nintendo gets to keep putting all of its first party stuff and whatever else it wants to do on there. I don't know that I'm 1,000% confident that's going to come true, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did.
That's Xbox's dream, isn't it? Imran, do you think that there will be an Xbox Game Pass app at some point on Nintendo Switch?
I would bet they've already talked about it. I imagine it's probably the same thing that's hypothetically still going on with Netflix, of Nintendo says you need to give us a cut and the other company says no. So I imagine that is going to be the long-term disagreement over all that stuff. I think at some point maybe somebody will relent, or maybe Switch gets a browser one day and we just get we log on to xbox.com/play or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen stuff like EA Play get integrated on Microsoft's platform, right? And you know, obviously Ubisoft's been playing with cloud gaming and having their little subscription system, but we really haven't heard much from Nintendo's camp on that sort of approach. I mean, for one, it's there are not as many games that would apply and be easily integrated unless it was cloud, so for like download services. But Nintendo has instead gone to its old partners and integrated classic games into their own subscription, right? So, or characters from their partners into their own games like Smash Brothers. I feel like the logical conclusion is that eventually, if Nintendo keeps going with a unique device like the Nintendo Switch, I think the logical conclusion is that they'll open it up to subscription services from other companies. But first, they want to build their own.
Yeah, Microsoft is trying to build an ecosystem, and they have been cultivating a strong relationship with Nintendo in recent years, which is why we had all those persistent rumors about Master Chief appearing in Super Smash Brothers, for example. So I think that this is only going to revive those rumors. I don't see it happening anytime soon, but call me in a couple of years. But if you want to hear more conversation about the big Activision Blizzard deal, I encourage you to check out.
This year, I decided I actually wanted to like follow hockey a little bit more than just the most casual of casuals. So I subscribed to a service that streams all of the NHL to your television. The Boston Bruins home opener, I went to watch it and boom, blackout restrictions apply, which I thought was kind of ridiculous because I'm still 200 miles away from Boston. But whatever, had I had NordVPN, that wouldn't have been a problem. I would have just gone in, changed my settings to another geographic area, and boom, I could have been watching all the Boston Bruins home games like it was nothing at all. So now I have NordVPN and I can watch the home games of my local teams streaming without being frustrated. It's the same thing with like Netflix. It has all these complicated licensing rules, which from one country to another don't really make sense. So something you could watch on South Korean Netflix, you won't be able to watch on the United States Netflix unless NordVPN, boom, switch to South Korea and you're watching whatever Korean drama that you want. I highly recommend you do that. I haven't done it myself, but people seem to enjoy them. And who am I to try to bring down people's enjoyment? NordVPN, more than just entertainment and sports availability, it's going to protect you, especially when you're traveling, when you're using public Wi-Fi. People are trying to get in there. They're creeping on you. Bad actors, people trying to steal your password, your bank account details. Who knows what the government's doing these days? I can't keep track. They're all over the damn place. NordVPN, it's going to protect you. It's going to protect up to 6 devices because I know you have at least that many devices in front of you right now that can hook up to the internet. Boom. Fastest VPN in the world. You're not going to get any buffering. You're not going to get any lagging. It's going to stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling, which they do. That's kind of sneaky, especially how much you're paying those guys. There's threat protection to protect you from viruses and malicious malware and whatever else. Unsavory actors are out there. If you want to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to NordVPN.com/NintendoVC. That's NordVPN.com/NintendoVC. Victor Charlie. That link is also going to give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There is no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nice of them, and I appreciate that.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this. Talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Podcast Unlocked, where I was a guest and I was talking to Ryan Miranda and Destin about the acquisition. We also talked about the lawsuits and labor issues, which was not something that we were able to quite get to in this particular segment, but it's time to move on now. Let's talk about some Nintendo numbers. We got a lot of numbers from 2021, and you know, we were kind of talking a little bit about whether or not Nintendo had a strong library in 2021. Well, they sure did have a very successful 2021. Regardless, Nintendo Switch was the best-selling console of 2021, both in terms of unit sales and dollar sales. Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl were the third best-selling games in December and fourth best-selling games the entire year in the U.S., in addition to being the best-selling games on the Switch. Overall, between Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl and new Pokemon Snap, physical sales were the best they've been for the series since 2000. Jeez. So, main takeaway, yeah. Pokemon's doing all right, aren't they, Imran?
Yeah, there's probably nothing anyone can, like, there's no way Game Freak can mess up enough for Pokemon to not do well, I feel like. And I think that's, you know, it's a testament to how strong that IP is, and it's the strong, probably the largest IP, I think, by numbers in the world at this point. I don't think there's going to be like much change. There's no, that boat is too big to move, but also it's too like financially risky to ever really move that boat in a way that I think some number of Pokemon fans are very vocal about.
I also think it's so remarkable. Like if you think about the game being the third best-selling game, they're competing with games that are on 4 platforms. Like, you know, yeah. Some of the games ahead of them are sold across PlayStation 4, PlayStation 5, Xbox One, Series X, right? Like, and Switch in some cases. So that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I would also add to that, too. These are NPD numbers. And the weird thing about Nintendo with NPD is they can only get physical sales from, they get physical and digital for most of the other companies that the NPD reports on, but Nintendo's are only physical. So the actual likelihood is that some of those numbers were even higher when you count digital sales, but they just don't have the numbers to track through. Because it's all their Nintendo's eShop, and Nintendo doesn't want to report those to anybody. So
the quarter, yeah.
Right. So it's entirely possible that that was like actually much higher, that Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl were even higher. The comparison with the best since 2000 is also a little bit tricky, because in 2000, that was the year that Pokemon Gold and Silver came out in the US. And that there were only physical sales then. There were no digital sales of Pokemon Gold and Silver when they first came out. So technically, Pokemon has been having better years than 2000, probably for a long time now when you incorporate digital sales. But the fact that physical sales alone of Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl, 2 remakes that...
Yeah, I know. They remakes,
too. That people had questions about, honestly. I mean, I really liked them, but people... It's not a big... It's not a big, like, tentpole, like, Sword and Shield release. It's not like that. And technically, that the sales comparison they're making also included new Pokemon Snap, like basically any other Pokemon sales they did that year. But the fact that Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl were able to sort of carry that for them last year, I think is a testament to what Imran's saying. Yeah, there's really if it says Pokemon on it, it's going to sell. It doesn't really matter.
I still remember when the first Pokemon games came out in the West and exploded. There were a lot of calls of, this is a fad. You know, people are going to tire of it. And it's just, it seems to be not a fad.
No. Mm. No,
confirmed. Pokemon is not a fad.
Nuts. I mean, it's quite remarkable how like this games didn't look like this. Games didn't like Pokemon was so unique when it came out in the West because the market was dominated by very different games, and now it's just this kind of rock. It's this mainstay that will perform anytime there's a new game.
Yeah, I do wonder what this year is going to look like for Pokemon, because they have Legends Arceus coming out at a time that it's a very different Pokemon game than what we've seen before, looks like. And it also is coming out in January, not the holiday season. So do they have something else Pokemon planned for later in the year?
Surely Colosseum, right?
Oh, I don't know. Or do they just make a big push with, like, is Arceus a game that gets DLC? Because the Sword and Shield DLC, I understand, did pretty well for them.
I could see
and,
it. I could see an expansion pack, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I wonder what this year will be like for Pokemon. We really don't have any further information because they're so busy on the marketing beat for Arceus. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think this is going to be a turning point in the Pokemon franchise in that regard, but I am curious.
And they've got so many options. They could go another Let's Go. They like the Black and White remake is probably inevitable. Like they could just go straight to Gen 9 next. Like it is they have so many ways to just make Pokemon bigger and bigger and amplify it on top of itself.
Yeah. Well, my popular opinion is that Game Freak should take a break and make more Pocket Card Jockey, but...
Oh, yeah, Pear.
Yeah, right?
All right, so there good. We go. So Let's. Good. This is now a Pocket Card Jockey podcast.
No, but for real, Pear, I mean, Pocket Card Jockey aside, I would love for Game Freak to take a break. They churn out a game or a big piece of content pretty much every year, and I think I said this in my Diamond and Pearl remake review, but I would love it if they would just hand off the Pokemon IP to studios like Ilka, you know, every couple of years or so and take a break or take more time to make something like really big and ridiculous, which I think
they
is what
can't take a break. They've got a media empire to maintain.
Yeah. I know, but I wish I love the idea of letting new studios tackle the Pokemon IP in interesting ways. I think we talked about on this podcast too. Like, remember Pokemon Conquest? That was really good. Did Game Freak make that? I don't even remember who did that, but
that was Koei Tecmo.
Yeah,
Nobunaga's ambition by way of Pokemon. So
that's right. Let Koei Tecmo do something. Whatever. Who cares? Sounds great.
Yep.
I would love for Pokemon to take a break a la Assassin's Creed a couple years ago, where they can actually get some time to really develop the idea, because I don't think Gen 9 is going to be happening this year. I think that they're going to take another year, especially with the pandemic happening and all these other projects swirling around, to properly get it right. But I kind of agree with you, Rev. I would love for Game Freak to A, scale up more to kind of match the requirements that are being put on them, because they're still a relatively small studio.
Yeah.
And B, take a breather and really make a banger of a game in terms of Pokemon. I liked Pokemon Sword Shield myself, but I think there were some legitimate criticisms to be had in the connected world being a little half-baked in many ways. So
they could really benefit from a Call of Duty style structure, which is like Game Freak does it like Gen 9, whatever, then Ilka does the next year, then Bandai Namco has the year after that, for not for a mainline game, but for like a Pokemon thing. And then they come back for 3 years later with the next gen.
Yeah.
I agree.
Well, here are some other top sellers for Nintendo in 2021. Mario Kart 8, still hanging in there at number 7. Super Mario 3D World at number 10. Animal Crossing New Horizons at number 14. And Super Smash Bros. Ultimate at number 17. There was a notable absence from the top 20, and it breaks my heart a little bit. Metroid Dread did not crack the top 20 sales for 2021. I mean, it sounds like by all accounts, Metroid Dread exceeded expectations and was a success in terms of sales, but it kind of drives home that Metroid, for whatever reason, just does not sell, or it is a cult favorite, I want to say.
Yes.
Yeah. it sold way better than it ever has. Like, this is by far the best-selling Metroid game. I'm pretty sure it probably broke a million at this point. Like, I think that's going to be the enduring legacy of Switch sales, is not the mega sellers like Animal Crossing and Pokemon and all in Mario Kart 8. It's going to be the fact that things that were once very, very niche get a big bump from the Switch. Like, Metroid is an example. This is the best-selling Metroid game. Shin Megami Tensei 5 also has, by this point, become the best-selling Shin Megami Tensei game. It's these small things that enough people own a Switch and enough people are excited by every, like, game du jour, game of the month, whatever. And they do happen to pick it up for $60, which is generally more than they've ever been before, that I think a Switch bump is a verifiable, observable phenomenon, and also something that when you are Nintendo and making the pitch to third parties of why a game should come to Switch, this is a good way to show them why.
It is wild to me, and I understand why, but it is still wild to me that a frankly half-baked remake of Pokemon Diamond and Pearl was able to be the best-selling Nintendo Switch game of 2021, and so much further above than Metroid Dread.
It was half-baked.
It was a Unity. It was developed in the Unity engine. It was outsourced. And it was very buggy.
Why does that make it half-baked? You just said you wanted them to do more outsourcing.
Did I say that I wanted them to do more outsourcing? I think that was a Rev and Imran take.
You agreed.
I think it's half-baked, but not because it's outsourced. Because it was a game that needed to come out when it came out and not any later because Arceus is in the way.
I liked it. I thought it was a good, faithful remake. Watch my review.
But can we agree that the kind of like the effort level doesn't seem to be? It's not. Think about remakes on the market and like what Capcom does with a Resident Evil or Square does with a Final Fantasy, or you know, arguably what we've seen even with Metroid remakes. It seems like a little bit more work is put in than what we get out of the Pokemon franchise.
Right. Now listen here, you. I think that there is a desire for what Pokemon used to be, even if it's not super quantifiable. And at least some of that desire is this top-down, turn-based, simple RPG that people really, really liked and continued to like for a very long time, like into basically Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon, effectively, until it jumped to the Switch. And I think Sword and Shield especially showcased what we sort of lost when we moved away from that format. And I think it definitely just sold that many because Pokemon, the name Pokemon was attached to it. But I do think that, and this is one of the reasons I really loved it, because the remake specifically embraced that element of Pokemon, this like simpler, top-down, straightforward, no Z moves, no mega evolution, none of this other nonsense, just turn-based RPG. It was solid, and Diamond and Pearl were good games to begin with, and it just remade them, made them look a little nicer and a little more colorful on a Switch, and frankly that was pretty good.
For better or worse, the new Super Mario Brothers of Pokemon, of like we're going back to this old thing, we're making it look real simple, maybe intentionally, maybe not, who knows, and like it then sold really, really well and created its own like niche audience. Not niche, but its own subset.
Yeah, you're not
fine.
Wrong.
All we're saying is that Metroid Dread deserves better.
Yes,
because it's a better game, and it was more. It's very faithful to the classic 2D Metroids.
Turn-based RPGs are more accessible to a much, much wider audience
for sure
than the scary noise that the little robots made. Every time I woke up in the morning and was upstairs washing my face, I hear Imran playing and the Emmy noise is playing and freaking me out.
You know,
it's
that's a really
too.
Metroid's great. I'm not trying to rag on
Metroid.
You're not. You know, that's a really interesting point, Rev, because the conventional wisdom is that turn-based RPGs are outdated or old or that kind of thing, and that everybody wants to go real time. So, but you might not be wrong. A turn-based kind of setup might be less intimidating overall, and that might be kind of the secret to why Pokemon has been able to continue to be relevant over the past 20 years. That and the fact that, you know, it has some of the most identifiable characters in media today, but whatever.
Yeah, well, Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl made a bunch of most accessible games of 2021 lists, not because Nintendo or Ilka or Game Freak or Pokemon Company or anybody sits down and thinks about accessibility really, really hard, which we saw with Let's Go. They did not do this, but because it's just a turn-based RPG. You can basically just play it with one hand, hitting one button at a time. There's no reflex. You need like some mental skill to be able to play it, but you don't need any particular physical skill to play it. And that's why little kids can eventually get through a Pokemon game just as easily as an adult who wants that more in-depth post-game battle kind of stuff that they dig into.
I think like one thing about Pokemon that's underrated in terms of like mass appeal is that everyone's journey is going to be different. You and your friends are not going to have the same team. You're not going to battle the same ways. You're going to like have curated versions of your own journey, which allows you to talk about them, take pictures on the internet, tell your friends, which is not something that you can easily do with, say, Mario or Metroid Dread. That said, I think Metroid Prime 4 is going to sell pretty well, probably outsell Dread handily. Yeah.
And how many parents bought a copy and then bought a copy for their kids, and so, in effect, mm-hmm. they were double dipping?
Yeah. Yep. And for Nintendo, probably it means they need multiple Switches in the house for all their kids because nobody wants to share.
They got a hell of a racket going on here. No, seriously.
I'm curious if Arceus like sells notably less because of that. Like, we'll never know why exactly. If it does sell less, I think we'll probably sell more. But if it does not have that double dip number, then I bet you the next Pokemon Legends is going to be like Pokemon Legends Arceus or Dialga and Palkia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
It will be really interesting to see if Nintendo is able to keep up the momentum in 2022. I said in the beginning of the year that it was my opinion that this was going to be the absolute peak, and not the least because, in effect, Nintendo is running back 2017 with games like Breath of the Wild 2 and Splatoon 3. But I think there are real questions about whether Nintendo Switch can once again be the top-selling console of 2022. I thought it got a big boost from Switch OLED and the fact that the Xbox Series X and the PS5 were so hard to find, but things might change a lot in 2022, not the least because Starfield is coming out on Xbox, among other things. So something to watch, but something else we got to discuss. Hey, we got a new Nintendo Switch Online expansion pack game. And it's Banjo-Kazooie. And I think this game kind of resonates a lot in the hearts of Nintendo fans because Banjo-Kazooie, of course, is one of Rare's most famous games. It came from the peak, arguably, of the Rare-Nintendo relationship. In that way, it's not unlike, say, a Super Mario RPG from the days when Square and Nintendo were best of friends. And of course, Microsoft went and bought Rare, continuing the theme of acquisitions in this episode, and Banjo-Kazooie went away for a very long time until finally returning for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, and now Nintendo Switch Online Expansion Pack. And it's coming out today. It's not out yet. Pear, you reviewed.
I just checked.
Is it out?
No, I just checked. It's still not out.
Okay. Well, maybe it'll be out by the time this episode goes live, but Pear, you reviewed Banjo-Kazooie back in the day for IGN.com. So I'm quite curious, what's your perspective on it in the year of our Lord 2022?
Yeah, obviously it's one of the greatest games of the 18th century, so it's been a while. No, it's, first of all, just to start off, I think it's really funny when we think about controversies in video gaming, everybody will point to something like the Wind Waker reveal and people being upset over, you know, Baby Link and the cel-shaded look. Banjo-Kazooie was actually a controversial announcement because the game had been rumored and kind of leaked for a while as Project Dream. Mm. So it was actually called Dream Land of Giants. It was an isometric game that Rare was working on even, you know, before the N64 was out. And so we kept on hearing about this amazing Project Dream. And in our minds, you know, at the time, we're thinking of like crazy wild ideas from Rare, who obviously were established and a quality game maker after GoldenEye and all that. And then it got announced at Banjo-Kazooie. And even though there was no social media back then, everybody complained. They just complained to us. We got thousands and thousands of emails with people being upset over the baby name Banjo-Kazooie, and this is now ruined and they'll forever not play it. And then obviously it came out. It was beautiful, and it's funny, and it's well designed, and it really showed that a non-Nintendo development studio could make a game of the quality of Super Mario 64, and people would love it and remember it. And then, yeah, I reviewed it back in 1998 when it came out, and I gave it a high 9 score back when we had the decimal point scores. It's just such a, from a technical perspective, it was really remarkable because it used over texture blending. So instead of the kind of flat look, it actually had multiple textures layered on top of each other. And like they faked lighting through texture work in ways that really developers weren't doing at the time. But it also just was just genuinely funny. The animal noises, the rhymes of Gruntilda the Witch were really well written. Stupid stuff like being able to turn into a washing machine. I just was a gorgeous, like big open level a game. And I think it's a much better game than Banjo-Tooie even to date.
Mm. Where do you fall on the Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie debate? Because there have been plenty of people who are like, Banjo-Kazooie is a better game than Mario 64. I mean, more people have played Mario 64 over the years. It's a staple of speedrunning and such. But you could argue that Banjo-Kazooie is certainly more sophisticated. What's your take, Pear?
It's a tough one because I think in my review I wrote that it is the best 3D platformer of all time, surpassing Mario 64. But, you know, over the years, you go back and you play these games. It's really tough for me to make that call. Super Mario 64 just succeeds in having these really kind of compact, small worlds where platforming is really the star. Banjo-Kazooie isn't as much about like the accuracy of jumping. It is much more of an exploration and kind of more mission-based game. But, you know, Banjo does more, has more variety, certainly looks a hell lot of just much, much better. And then the music is just fantastic. Like audio design, visuals all come together. So I can see both arguments. Super Mario 64 feels more inventive and compact for its time. And then Banjo-Kazooie just surpassed it on scope, honestly.
Reb, did you play Banjo-Kazooie when it first came out?
I was 7. No.
Wait, you didn't play video games at 7?
Not really, actually. Oh. Not until I was like 9 or 10 when I got my first Game Boy Color did I actually start playing video games. I did, however, at around that age, well, a few years older than that, occasionally go to my next door neighbor's house to play Donkey Kong 64, which I have been known on this podcast as a Donkey Kong 64 stan. I've played the first hour of Banjo-Kazooie because I believe it's on Game Pass or something. And mm-hmm. I really
it's on
like
Retro Replay.
That's it. That's what I'm thinking of. And I really like it. I think I like it because it reminds me of playing Donkey Kong 64. Is mostly why it just evokes a very particular memory. But I think at some point, maybe now that it's on Nintendo Switch Online, maybe for some other reason, I think I would like to revisit it. It looks like fun.
The atmosphere is so cool. Like there's, you know, there's a level, obviously, there's one with a giant mechanical whale shark thing.
Yeah.
And it's just the way it looks, there's a scary level where you're butt stomping a piano, like an organ and stuff. It's just, it's so creative, and it has it goes beyond that whimsical atmosphere of Mario to do something that's a little bit feels like Pirates of the Caribbean sometimes, and sometimes like Haunted Mansion. It's like Disney Mario 64.
Good era for Rare.
Smash Brothers Ultimate turned me around a bit on Banjo-Kazooie because I had always been like, ah, Banjo-Kazooie, they're so lame. Because when it first came out, I looked at it and I saw it, much like Diddy Kong Racing, as an off-brand version of a Nintendo game. And I know that's a controversial statement because mm-hmm. for a lot of different reasons, but that's how I felt at the time. This is what Teenage Cat was thinking. Now, as for the modern, so I think that bias kind of carried with me until I played Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. And I was like, wow, Banjo-Kazooie, they're such fun, well-realized characters. I think they're the most enjoyable of all of the DLC characters to come out. And that made me think about Banjo-Kazooie, and I think in a much more positive light, ultimately. Imran, did you ever play Banjo-Kazooie? And what's your take on the series?
I did. So when I played it originally, this is like baby Imran game design brain. The thing that got me was when you play Mario 64, the stars are like objective markers. They could be check marks, they could be coins, they could be whatever. But they basically say, you did this thing. You threw King Bob-omb 3 times. You found 100 coins. You did all this stuff. In Banjo-Kazooie, what got me was that they weren't objective markers anymore. They were you found this in the area. This is like, there are six of these jiggies, these notes, whatever. And like, that is what that game was based around, is the idea of like, you found this versus you did this thing. And that wasn't what I wanted back then. When I replayed it on Rare Replay, which as far as I know is probably the definitive version at this point, like even counting Switch Online. But when I replayed it on Rare Replay, I liked it a lot more. I was warned to stay away from Banjo-Tooie because whatever I liked about Banjo-Kazooie would make me dislike Tooie. So I've not played that one yet. But I have come around like you, Kat, in recent years and been like, yeah, this game's all right.
That's exactly it. It is an exploration-based game. So you discover something, right? Like you'll... In Mario, you pick a mission. There's some stars you can get where you weren't planning on getting them, right. Obviously, like the red coins or something. But like in Banjo, it's like, here's a smaller open world and you're let loose and you discover something. Like you shoot an egg into a pot and like a voice goes, thank you. And you're like, what does that mean, right? And so then you play around with the game systems, you need to discover all this fun stuff. So it is much more sandboxy. And then Tooie basically goes even bigger. It makes the world really big. And I think they lost a little bit of their focus there. It's still really good. I wouldn't say stay away from it, but Kazooie is a better game. Mm.
If you're watching the video, they're showing the Smash reveal of Banjo and Kazooie. And I'm just so remembering how
it's the best one. It's the best
so
one.
Good.
Yeah.
The running gag from revealing K. Rool and then really good.
But I love, Kat, I love your take on it, because even at the time when these games were coming out, it felt like Rare was just trying to be Nintendo. Like they made a game and so it was like, it's Mario mixed with Zelda. And it was never, this is a Rare game like GoldenEye again, right? Like Dinosaur Planet, whatever, Star Fox Adventures was like, it's Star Fox, but Zelda, right? Like it all felt very derivative and you had to just kind of take a step back and go, well, this is a Nintendo studio now. And that's what, you know, that's what they should be doing as part of the portfolio. But Rare was always best when it invented something, when it wasn't trying to do Mario Kart. Like Disney, the Mickey Speedway game is just, it's kind of like a symbol of the downfall of this amazing developer. And not to say that they can't, you know, return to greatness. They're making some cool stuff. You know, Viva Pinata was really, really clever, I thought. But yeah, I like them best when they're not trying to be Nintendo.
I was always a Battletoads fan, but Banjo-Kazooie, number 4 on our list of the top 25 N64 games. You should go check that out. It should be out on Nintendo Switch Online Expansion Pack later today. All right, it's time now for the Invincibility Star. We're going to do a really quick news rundown and run through a bunch of news stories like Turtle Shells and Super Mario Brothers. First up, GDQ wrapped up last week really quick. Did you all have a favorite run, Reb?
Oh, mine's probably the same as Imran's, but the Sekiro blindfolded run was sick. Whoa. How? I don't even know.
Pear just ran away the second that we talked about GDQ.
He's speedrunning out of here.
Imran, how about you?
Yeah, it was a Sekiro run. I've actually got an interview with that guy publishing later today. Nice. So if anyone's curious about that.
Sorry, I had to step away because my dog had to take a run.
It's okay, my cat just pulled my webcam, Dan.
This is why I closed the door.
Pear, did you have a favorite GDQ run?
I actually didn't get to watch it yet. I have to catch up. I was busy with IGN stuff.
Aren't we all?
Yep.
Not me.
Pokemon Legends Arceus has leaked. They're already out there. This is a very common occurrence for Pokemon. So I just want to warn you all, be careful of spoilers because there's a lot out there already. Kingdom Hearts Cloud Collection on Switch is coming out in February. It can be purchased individually or as a bundle for $89.99, which is, that's a price. And I'm going to level with you. I know there are plenty of people who only roll with the Nintendo Switch. I don't think the cloud version of Kingdom Hearts is the way to experience the series. It's out on a lot of platforms at this point. Maybe get one of those.
This is the thing that turned me off with the Stadia model, right? Like cloud gaming to me, when it's a subscription service, I kind of get it and I don't feel like I'm missing out on something. But when I'm paying $90 and the cloud service on Switch is not great, right? What happens in 3 years? right? Like, will there still be a cloud service and my purchase will still apply? Or is it like, whoops, sorry, you gave us $90 and it's no longer accessible. You can no longer play it.
The latter.
That is, yeah, I think that, look, that is the big issue, right? Like, I was looking at some old games the other day, and like on the Nintendo Satellaview service in Japan, there was a Super Famicom Wars. There was a Super NES version of Advance Wars.
Yeah.
And it's gone. It's gone. You can never play it again. You can never see it again.
The Japanese version of Super Punch-Out was only available through 7-Eleven and like a download cart, which is you'll never find again.
I hate that.
Well, this just goes to the physical versus digital debate. And you know what? I'm a physical gal all the way. But speaking of cloud versions, Dying Light 2 delayed to at least August. So that's another delay that's happening. And I don't know, like Dying Light 2 has been being pushed really hard. It's remarkable how little hype there is around this game. And God knows if you're going to play Dying Light 2, I don't think you're going to be playing it on Nintendo Switch, but we'll see if it ends up being good once the cloud version's out. And finally, something I want to highlight. Well, there hasn't been a Nintendo Direct this month, and it's a little surprising. Or I should ask, Imran, are you surprised that there's been no Nintendo Direct?
No, because once they got the Kirby did out there, it was like, okay, this month is just about Arceus then. Like, so I think maybe we'll get one. We'll definitely get one this quarter because they've just got nothing past Kirby. They've got really nothing dated. But beyond that, there was that time, that 1 year where they just did not do directs for most of the year and we're only doing Twitter drops. It's not impossible Nintendo does that again, but I would be shocked if they don't have some kind of direct saying, okay, here's our updates. Let's keep you tied up until E3 time or whatever the next big showcase direct is.
At the very least in February, because then once Arceus is kind of out of the way and they can do a Nintendo Direct that maybe focuses a bit on Kirby and, you know, the digital releases and such that are coming out in the coming months.
I mean, look, Metroid Dread got announced and released in the same year, right? There's nothing to indicate that Nintendo would suddenly change and that the games that we think are coming, Bayonetta, Zelda 2, all that would be it. I do think that there's going to be a Q1 direct or with a major announcement.
They always have at least one thing that they announce and end up releasing the same year. Wasn't Xenoblade Chronicles announced and then released pretty much the same year?
Yeah.
That's right.
Look, yep. There are people online who make their entire brands out of predicting Nintendo Directs. there is no, you cannot predict Nintendo Directs. Nintendo has, there is no pattern. There are no rules. When Nintendo feels like having a Direct, My imagining is that sometimes Mr. Furukawa just wakes up in the morning and says, let's do a Nintendo Direct tomorrow, send the tweet, and then throws the trailers together, and then it just appears. That's my imagining for how this happens. So, you know, just vibe, folks. Nintendo will announce some stuff whenever they feel like it, and there's nothing we can do about it.
I don't know if you ever talked to developers that are in Directs, but they also will like, yeah, Nintendo asked us for stuff 4 months ago, and we have no idea when the Direct is. So, like, even people involved don't know when a Direct is.
All the time, and then your game, you think your game is in it, and then it gets kicked out, and they're like, what? Oh, we weren't included in the Direct after all. Like, it definitely is, it definitely seems like it's a little bit all over the place, but maybe there's order to the chaos. Maybe whenever the Nintendo stock price goes slightly down, they go, bloop, bloop, release the hounds, and all the games come out.
All right, it is time now for the Cat Take, the segment in which I rant a bit about a industry subject that is of interest to me. And since the theme of this episode is acquisitions, this is my Cat Take. Acquisitions are bad. And I don't think that this is a super controversial take, but if I had my way, zombie Teddy Roosevelt would be coming through and busting all of those trusts, not just Xbox, but Sony and Nintendo and many other companies. I do not like seeing the consolidation of the video game industry because it has the effect of consolidating all of the power into the hands of a very few. Newly minted Microsoft game CEO Phil Spencer has an outsized influence in the video game industry. And yeah, he may wield that power for good in the short term, but more and more we are at the whims of whatever the heck Microsoft wants to do. And I don't particularly like that. competition, a free market. These are all things that theoretically capitalists want to have. Well, let's have it. Consolidation is bad. That's my cat take.
Good take.
I think it's a good take. I think there are acquisitions. There are lots of acquisitions that didn't work out. I mean, like I mentioned Guitar Hero earlier. Look at what happened. Look at what happened to that franchise. Look at what happened to Neversoft, who dazzled us with Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, right? Like lots of stuff happens over time. But there are the occasional positive stories where a game studio that might not make it on its own gets acquired and then its IP lives on forever, right? Like some of Nintendo's second parties might not be around today, and we might not have games like Fire Emblem or even Kirby if there hadn't been an acquisition of a studio like that. But there are lots of stories where major corporations buy something and then are unable to do something with it. You know,
yeah.
Toys for Bob. Look at that.
How many classic franchises have died because they were gobbled up by, for example, EA? I mean, think about the death of, for example, Ultima, Wing Commander. You just go through the line. And I'm not saying that that's going to happen with Xbox's acquisitions, but even if Call of Duty is bigger than ever, even if Activision Blizzard's, even if they manage to fix the problems at Blizzard and Diablo and World of Warcraft and Overwatch are doing well, that is still too much power in the hands of one particular platform holder.
Yeah, I think like you can't really let Activision operate the way it's been operating either. Like,
absolutely
this,
not.
This is one of those cases where the house either needed to burn down or be sold to someone else. And I agree with you. The consolidation is just an absolutely an overall negative. But like, if there is a single virtue of this, it's Activision was unsustainable in so many ways, even from a software development perspective. Something needed to happen.
Yeah. And like for me, if I get a new Warcraft or a Starcraft, not World of Warcraft, but proper RTS Warcraft out of it, I'm totally fine. And I have seen Microsoft
bring back Starcraft.
I've seen Microsoft invest in franchises that might not have been the biggest sellers, like like even Halo Wars, we got a sequel, right? And so I'm hoping that maybe there's a little bit of attention levered to some of the franchises that are sitting in the Activision Blizzard park or forgotten dreams, like Lost Vikings and all of that.
Yeah, but I think it also is a symbol of what is sort of ailing the industry, which is rising costs, a focus on mega franchises, the kind of the rot of the middle class of the games industry.
Yeah.
And I just think it's kind of anti-competitive to see Microsoft shrug and say, we're literally throwing $75 billion at this company to get them into our portfolio. While I can see in the individual terms, like how this could be good for, say, cleaning up the toxic culture of Activision Blizzard, or potentially bringing back a game like Warcraft or Starcraft, I think big picture, it really makes me worried for the next 5-10 years of the games industry.
Yeah, it's the principle.
Go ahead.
It's the principle right there. We are now dependent on Phil Spencer to do all of this, correct? We are dependent on him to bring all these old games back. We are dependent on him to clean up Activision Blizzard. We are dependent on him to do all of these other things with all of these other companies that previously were independent. And while on an individual basis, you know, maybe he will make better decisions than would have been made otherwise, it is, I think Kat's point is that effectively we're dependent on, in the end, the buck stops with this one guy for how much of the industry at this point? I mean, what percentage of the industry does Microsoft now
Activision
own?
Activision Blizzard and Bethesda alone. I mean, those are two of the biggest publishers in the games industry. And I think we're just in a better place if we have games like Call of Duty on as many platforms as possible. If we have games like Starfield, not as an Xbox exclusive, sorry. So,
but here's what happens, and this is the old guy talking. It's very cyclical, right? Like you get all these big franchises being gobbled up and, you know, get all this consolidation, and then creative minds leave, right? Like a star designer at Rockstar leaves, the level designer of the Doom franchise leaves, and new studios are being founded. And usually what happens then is they create something new. They create a new brand. And some of our favorite franchises today are not that old, right? Like, think of something like, you know, a Naughty Dog or even Ghost of Tsushima, right? That is a new IP that hadn't been around for a long time. And I do think that we will see the return. We will see new studios come in with new brands. And also, Kat, you did see the return of the middle class. You've got the definition of triple B and THQ is back, right? So,
oh God.
Atari is around in some fashion, right?
So Atari, some of these, the crypto scam.
I know. Some of these old brands revive themselves.
Embracer's acquiring everyone, including THQ. Right. So,
yeah.
What's
yeah.
funny is that indies have become the middle class because the so-called AAA indie, right?
Yeah, that's becoming
that's the definition of the middle class. Yeah.
I think ultimately the scary thing is that we're not depending on Phil Spencer for these things. We're depending on unchecked capitalism to solve the problems caused by unchecked capitalism.
Yeah. I would also add to the point you're making, Pear, sure, they'll break off and form their own studios, but they didn't, in order to form those studios, they are then very often dependent on funding from, again, the same like three guys at the top of everything in order to function. Because there is kind of this cyclical thing happening, right? Where like the middle class of the games industry, the sort of double A, triple A indie, whatever that is, hollows out. It disappears. Either those studios fall apart and go away, or they get acquired by bigger companies and they disappear, and then it builds back up again, and then they disappear. And it's kind of this wave that keeps going. But every time that cycle happens, the people at the top acquire more companies and get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just keeps happening.
The market hates stability, and things always change. Like, think of the streaming sector with Netflix. Netflix was the only one. And now if you're looking at Netflix's share in streaming, every year it's going down slightly because now there's HBO Max, Showtime, like, you know, Disney Plus, all of these classic companies are reinventing themselves as streamers. I mean, we talked earlier about there's, you know, PlayStation, Nintendo, and Microsoft, but there's Google waiting in the wings. Maybe they'll get it right next time, right? Like, they certainly have the pockets for it. There's Apple, and Apple is working on a VR headset and making a bigger entry. And obviously Amazon being a big story. So maybe there'll be more big cats giving money and then it'll get consolidated again. But I just...
Yeah, you mentioned Netflix. Yeah. Netflix is making a play in the games industry as well. Mm-hmm. And
that's right.
Yeah, I think this is emblematic of a huge shift in the games industry as old players are gobbled up by the biggest fish and new players come in. But by and large, I think that consolidation under megacores like Xbox or like Microsoft and Google, not great, honestly.
No, of course not.
Giving these tech concerns so much power in everything, not great. And it's not just the video game industry.
No, it's like, look at the Madden franchise, right? Like, unopposed, it didn't soar. It stagnated and it became like a FIFA. These sports games became worse because 2K wasn't there to keep innovating and then in turn EA pushing to innovate. No, that's absolutely true. It's cyclical. Yeah. There'll be new companies being formed and really creative minds will never sit still and be happy to be a cog in the wheel at a big corporation. They're gonna want to be movers and shakers, and you'll get some new games studios out of it.
It's also like an overtly political question, because like the Biden administration is trying to break up Facebook, which is the right call, but also there's almost no chance the Activision Microsoft thing is ever going to get looked at by the DOJ or
no.
You know, FTC will look at it, but they'll wave it off. This things that like you were mentioning, the ghost of Roosevelt coming back, mm-hmm. they had more political will to regulate companies back then for this sort of thing, which they don't now.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more that we could discuss. I mean, honestly, this could be an entire episode discussing the implications of trust busting and all of that. But let's talk about video games. Let's talk about what we've been playing. And Imran, we'll start with you. What have you been playing?
I think I mentioned at the top, I've been playing way too much Genshin Impact. I've been playing Final Fantasy XIV with Reb here, where we try to do main story quests, and that game is just not co-op friendly at all. Where we are trying to go into main, like go alongside the main story quest, but we'll go to a thing, and then like even though we're both doing the same quest, fighting the same enemies, the game will go, actually, you can't be in a party for this. We're going to give you a little cutscene, and then you guys have to break up the party, then reconvene the party afterwards, which is real nuts to me because that's not how I understand MMORPGs to work. It's a very good game. I'm enjoying it a lot, but that, like, just let me stay in the party. That's all I'm really asking for.
Yeah. You guys should play Sea of Thieves then.
We could.
Don't give me more games. Don't give me more like ongoing live service games. I quit WoW and then I got roped into this Final Fantasy 14 nonsense. Don't do this.
Mm. Yeah, I stopped playing FIFA because I was just like, at a certain point, it was a treadmill. And I said to myself, wait a minute, I could be playing other games that are really good, like Nintendo games and Bloodborne. And so I stopped playing it. I want to highlight really quickly an indie game that I played over the weekend with some friends. Lovers and a Dangerous Space-Time. It came out in 2017. It's on Nintendo Switch. Delightful party game. So the premise is you're flying around in a spaceship. Everybody is controlling a different part of it. You have your gunners, and you have your pilot, and you have your shield operator. You can fire what we were calling the Yamato cannon with it. And your goal is to rescue little space bunnies from the forces of anti-love. And it's a little bit like a EDM fever dream in a big old spaceship. It is delightful and intense and causes so much discussion as people are playing. And I love communication when everybody's getting together. The Omicron variant, of course, makes getting together with friends difficult. But in a happier time, a time that is more filled with love, I recommend checking out Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time, which is takes a concept that I really enjoy, flying around in a spaceship, and adds such a layer of fun and just this unique vibe to it. It's really fun.
It was a big hit when it first came out in the Schneider household. We played it with four players. I have three kids, so it's just really clever. I love these. There was an era where we got a lot of these asymmetric co-op games, right, where you had different roles for different people. And this one is one of the best out there. It's so much fun. You get mad, but you also have just a ton of fun.
Yeah, asymmetric co-op. That is a great way to describe it. And we've had those kinds of games in the past, but I think this might actually be the best realization of the concept of everybody's flying a spaceship together and operating different stations. It's one part almost like twin stick shooter and arcade game and one part strategy game. Very smart. I'm really glad I finally got to play it. And Per, what have you been playing?
I mean, obviously, I'm still Forza-thoning around and like
still
talking about live
Forza.
Games.
Wow.
I'm curious to see how long it's going to capture me. Like, I do the seasonal challenges, and I maxed out on this season. Like, I'm totally hooked. I love cars too. So it's just beautiful. Anyway, on the Nintendo Switch, I'm actually. I don't know, almost random. I started Doki Doki Literature Club, and I'm still not sure why. I think it's because Jose, like ages ago, Jose and I talked about it, and he was playing it, and he's like, yeah, dude, this game is weird, but you know, it's got this twist to it. And so I got curious, and I saw it. I think it was up for sale, so I bought it, and I started it. And yeah, it's just it's a horny talkie-talkie game right now. So we'll see where it goes.
Wait, do you not know?
No, I don't know. I saw some of the content warnings and stuff. So I didn't spoil it for myself. But I heard that there was a twist on it. That was the motivator to finally check it out. And it's definitely not my kind of game so far. High school dating games usually don't play that much off. But we'll see where it goes, and then we'll see if I like it. But then also, yeah, I'll tell you, Reb. Once I get to that point, whatever it is, I'm sure it's going to be a cooking simulator. Picross 7, obviously I'm playing Picross 7, same as Picross 6, just with touchscreen. And then Death's Door, it's one of the games in my backlog. Reb, I know you recommended it, so I jumped on that one. It's like a mini Legend of Zelda game in a way. I wish it had a map. That is my one piece of feedback. I wish we had made a map for it for IGN, but it's a little late now. But maybe in the future, we'll do a little bit more support like that. But I dig
Gown
it. I think it's
maps.
Really cool. Yep. That's it.
And Reb, how about you?
I am currently playing a game I can't talk about until next week, so I'll see you then.
Gee, I wonder what it is.
What games are coming out? But in the evening when I thought I was going to be getting a code for that game and did not get a code until the next day, I played about an hour of Bowser's Fury, which I had not played before. I really like it so far. I have no idea when I'll be able to come back to it, given the scope of the thing I am currently playing that I can't talk about. But I like it. It has vibes of Mario Sunshine, which I am a diehard apologist for no good reason. But then it also feels a little bit like Mario Odyssey in sort of the way that you find these little cat shines. I love that everything is cats. I didn't realize how little information I actually had in my brain about this game because all these little things were surprising me. Like when, like the very first time you get the little cat bell and turn into the big lion thing. I had never seen that before and it was really exciting. And when Plessy shows up and I'm just like jumping around in the water and it's just fun. It feels very Nintendo Toy Box to me, which I know is the theme we were talking about earlier. And I didn't realize how much I missed that because it's been, I guess it's been a year or two since I've played a proper like Nintendo-y Toy Box kind of game.
Stick with it. I've really loved it. And I was kind of surprised how quickly it went. Like the discussion just died down. And I think it's because it was presented almost like the B-side for this re-release of a really good other Mario game. I just think it's such a cool experiment. They basically just did a more confined open world Mario Sunshine or Odyssey or Mario 64. I think it's really, really good. It's got so many clever little touches. The controls are killer, and it looks beautiful too. The kind of like the emerging Bowser kind of like mega event stuff gets a little old, but it's still a cool little element too.
It has been very funny watching Reb play because I'm like, you have a run button. You can use the run button. She's like, no, I'm going at a fast enough speed. I'm fine.
I'm just trotting along. It feels like if Mario Odyssey had a Breath of the Wild Great Plateau area. That's what it feels like to me. I like it. I don't know when I'm going to get back to it, but I want to try to make time for it. Maybe in a couple weeks.
Let's wrap up with a question block. This one is from Brett Taranzo, and keeping in with the theme of acquisitions, they want to know, will Microsoft's acquisition affect the indie scene? Switch has become the go-to for indies, but with Sony losing so many franchises, do you think they'll start featuring indies much more like the start of the PS4 era and cut into Switch's dominance in that space? What's your take, Imran?
I think Game Pass is probably the bigger thing because there's a big upfront payment for indies, which is, you know, you can put, like, you may make money elsewhere. Who knows? Maybe the Switch version would outsell it, but I think Game Pass is a better guarantee for a lot of indie developers who have spent years working on a thing and just need to be paid for it. I don't think Switch has been doing very well in terms of indies because Nintendo's out there actually making those partnerships, and the notoriety of being featured in one of those indie worlds is hard to like put a price value on. But I don't think either one is going to completely take over the scene completely. At least until the only way I could see it being a big deal is if indies at some point technologically outpace the Switch, which is not like impossible. There's games like Neon White that look like they're really struggling on that system. But for the most part, I think they're going to probably coexist fairly well for a while.
Yeah, I think that's a really good take. Every indie dev I talk to, they love Steam and they love Switch, right? Like Switch, and so some of them after not being able to sell big on Steam, they actually get a second wind on Switch. And if they're lucky enough to be discovered on that platform, they can sell really, really significant numbers. And so I think it's a little bit more difficult. And I think there's an expectation with a handheld that the graphics don't have to look like Halo Infinite or Uncharted or something like that. And so I think they feel at home on the Switch much more. But yeah, you're right, Imran. Like there are indie games are getting more sophisticated and the engines that are powering them are getting more sophisticated and easier to work with. So there will be a point where some of the more notable ones will no longer run on the Switch until, of course, there's another Switch.
I think that the Steam Deck is more interesting to watch on the indie front because, of course, so many of them come out on Steam well before they come out on Nintendo. And the Steam Deck really takes off. I think that will become a very popular venue to be able to play these indie games, and Nintendo will lose some of the appeal of being able to play them portably.
Yep.
See, I don't think... I've talked to many indies in the last year or so, and I've gotten a different vibe that the Switch is definitely... It has sort of a presence for indies, I think. Like, there's a certain feeling of, especially for certain kinds of indie games, of having your game on a Nintendo console, especially if you've been inspired by older Nintendo games. Mm-hmm. But unless you are one of those prestige indies that can get featured in an Indie Direct or a Nintendo Direct, then your discoverability on Switch is terrible. Like, you're up there for new releases, and then that's kind of it. And Sony has similar problems. I've written about the problems with indie discoverability
is bad in general.
It is bad
everywhere.
In general.
Every platform.
It's bad in general, but it is better on PC because you have a little more control over it. You can control that. You can control things like sales on Steam. You can sort of control where your audience goes and how they get to your games a little bit better. So PC is the ideal for everybody. But then on console, yeah, it is. I think Game Pass is sort of the easier thing for a lot of indies because you don't need to be an ID at Xbox title to get a Game Pass deal. You don't need to be in this sort of prestige category of indies that make the big marketing presentations. You can, if you have, it's not a guarantee that you'll be able to cut that kind of deal, but it is easier to get that sort of guarantee up front. And so, yeah, for console platforms, my vibe is that Xbox has been better for indies for about a year, maybe a little bit longer, just because of the discoverability problem growing and growing on the Switch. Whereas when it first came out, it was a great place for indies because there were just no games. And so it was easy to find your game. This space shifts constantly because whichever platform feels that they are falling behind in whatever area they feel they're falling behind in tends to court indies better because they need that software bump. They need to have more games that look really good and nice to make themselves look better. So that's kind of why PlayStation and Xbox have sort of changed hands over the years on who was friendlier towards indies. Nintendo just kind of occupies a space between them all the time. I don't know that this is going to hurt them dramatically. I don't even think the Steam Deck's honestly gonna, like, the Switch is gonna get the indies that it's going to get whether there's a Steam Deck or a Game Pass or not, because it's going to cut deals with a handful of prestige indies to put in its little Nindy showcases, and we'll love those and they'll be great, and everybody else will find their way, I guess.
Brett, thank you so much for the question, and that is all the time we have left for this week's Nintendo Voice Chat. Follow us on Twitter at NVC Podcast. Submit your question block questions on the NVC Facebook group. Thanks to our guest Imran Khan, as well as Kate on the ones and twos, and Logan behind the scenes. Most of all, thanks to all of you hanging out with us. And remember, NVC is the only place you can
get the thing.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to Season 1, we are thrilled to announce the launch of Season 2. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make Season 2 even more memorable together.